Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to a new analysis by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, the percentage of American Catholics who identify as strong members of the church has declined to a 40-year low. But that didn't stop the U.S. media from giving the new Pope Francis wall-to-wall coverage this week. He also got front-page coverage around the world. So was this coverage justified? What explains all of this? And because there was so much coverage, what did you learn about the Pope and the powerful Vatican? Did the child abuse scandal and cover-ups receive the coverage it deserves? And what about Argentina's military junta? What about that? Joining us to discuss coverage is McClatchy's Mark Seibel. Mark oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondence. He began his career at the Dallas Morning News in 1975. He covered Mexico and Central America as the Mexico bureau chief of the Dallas Times Herald. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. And I just want to let listeners know that in the second half of the show, we will be joined by two journalists who won James Madison Freedom of Information Awards prizes this week, and we'll be talking about the state of investigative reporting. So, Mark, as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see out there that you thought was done well?
Well, it's not a reporter's work that drew my attention. It's the work of the daughter of a guy who died in Mississippi by the name of Harry Stamps. Harry Stamps was a character, lived in Long Beach, Mississippi. He died the day daylight savings time went into effect, or the day before, 80 years old. And his daughter, who's a lawyer in Dallas, Texas, wrote the obituary, which became a viral sensation when it was published in the Sun Herald of Biloxi, Mississippi. And I don't know how I stumbled across it. Maybe somebody had tweeted it out or something. But I knew it was a different kind of obituary when I got to the portion about his local sourcing of food. And I just want to read it to you.
Okay.
Harry was locally sourcing his food years before chefs in California started using cilantro and arugula, both of which he hated. For his signature bacon and tomato sandwich, he procured 100% all-white bunny bread from Georgia, blue plate mayonnaise from New Orleans, Sire's black pepper from Virginia, homegrown tomatoes from outside Oxford, that'd be Mississippi, and Tennessee's Benton Bacon from his Bacon of the Month subscription.
Ooh.
As a point of pride, he purported to remember every meal he had eaten in his 80 years of life.
Wow.
Well, that was the tone of this obituary, and it gets down even to his discussion of how he believed daylight savings time was the devil's time, and that it was fitting that he died just hours before daylight savings time. Let me read that. He particularly hated daylight savings time, which he referred to as the devil's time. It is not lost on his family that he died the very day that he would have had to spring his clock forward. This can only be viewed as his final protest. Anyway, it was a very lighthearted obituary that I suspect really captured the man and probably really captured the way he created his family afterwards.
Hmm.
They understood who he was. And the piece did incredibly well on the Internet. I was reading something from the editor of the Biloxi paper who said they got more than 500,000 views of that on two consecutive days, which for a little paper in Mississippi is a lot of Internet activity.
Wow.
And then the story they wrote about who wrote the obit and that sort of thing about his daughter got another 100,000 views the next day. So they got a lot of traffic out of it. It was very popular, and it was my favorite story of the week.
And somehow you stumbled upon it. It's the mystery of social media. It's just amazing how certain things take off and other things go nowhere.
Absolutely.
Huh. Well, rest in peace, Harry Stamps. Well, thank you. So we'll link to that right after the show.
Sure.
So let's dive in here, Mark, and talk about wall-to-wall coverage of the Pope. First of all, I mean, it's almost like the media treated this like the royal wedding, right? I mean, were you surprised by how much coverage this got specifically in the U.S. media?
Well, not really. I mean, I wasn't surprised. You don't pick a pope very often. The pope is a person has authority over hundreds of millions of people's lives, some of them more so than others, even people who call themselves Roman Catholic, they don't always listen to his teaching. So it's something that doesn't come up very often. I think Pope Francis is particularly interesting as a person because, unlike the last pope, he hadn't spent 25 years in Rome doing you know, bureaucratic work of the church, and in a way, he's a lot like John Paul the second in that way, because John Paul also had a track record as a bishop, as a cardinal, as a person who was actually out among people doing real things. And certainly Pope Francis, when he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, and before that the Jesuit Superior in Argentina, has a track record of political involvement, involvement in worldly events as well as church events that make him an interesting character. So, you know, the Pope is an influence for a lot of people. He's obviously not picked very often. And this guy is going to be particularly interesting because he is someone whose record we can actually look at in temporal terms. And that's going to make him more interesting than some others.
So there are the obvious angles here. The fact that the Cardinals made history in selecting a pope from South America. A lot of media outlets are focusing on how they're calling him a, quote, humble champion of the poor, for example. That was Reuters' headline. A lot of the media are saying that, you know, he paid for his own hotel bill and he's more sort of laid back and down home. Okay, so that's all well and good. But what about other angles? I mean, this is a really good time for the media to look at the sheer power of the Vatican, for example. Did you see much of that coverage?
Well, I think it's going to be coming. The first day's coverage had a lot of what I would say is sort of the predictable angles, you know, the what you're talking about is his love of the poor and his humility, those kinds of things. I mean, the truth is, you sort of read that about every pope when he comes into office. You know, guy who defends the poor and he's a wonderful person and all those kinds of things. And so it doesn't surprise me in the first few days that would be the case, and in this this pope's particular background, I mean, I was reading things that were written, you know, years ago about him, and he is an unusual cleric in that as he went up the hierarchy, he never seemed to have forgotten that, you know, he wanted to take the bus to work. He did pay his own bills. I mean, it sort of recalled for me this whole incident of him in Rome after he was pope, stopping in at the lodge he had been housed in and paying the bill himself instead of sending somebody else over to do it. That sort of reminded me of Jimmy Carter when he was inaugurated as president, walking the parade route, carrying his own suitcases and that sort of thing, trying to send a message to the rest of his church. I guess he has no church peers, but the other cardinals and the archbishops that, you know, we take a vow of poverty, we ought to live it. And that's, you know, so I think that's an important part of his personality. But there's a richness to his experience. And I mean, speaking as a journalist, of his experiences that are going to be fodder for, news stories, I think, for some time. And of course, one of the stories coming up will be how he tackles the Vatican bureaucracy,
right,
and hierarchy.
Well,
I think we'll read that down the road some.
And on this question of the poor, because I did hear someone on, I believe it was NPR, say that he's against globalization and he's a champion for the poor. But what does his past say about how he's dealt with poverty?
Well, actually, he grew up poor. And one of the things that many people don't know about him is that he only has one lung. He only has one lung because he got an infection when he was growing up, and the way they dealt with it was to remove the other lung, which would be because he didn't have access to kind of medical care that might have allowed him to be treated with antibiotics and those kinds of things. I mean, and first off, he got a disease that was a common result of poverty. I was struck by one quote that we had in our initial story about him from somebody in Buenos Aires who just simply said, his reputation is that he is very kind to the poor and to drug addicts, and I hope he maintains that when he gets to the Vatican. So I think there is a firm belief that he was an advocate for the poor in Argentina. I haven't read anything, and I'm not aware of anything that makes me think that's not true. The beef about Bergoglio, as he was known before he became Pope Francis, is his role in Argentine politics and, of course, in the dirty war of the 1970s. And that's, you know, something that we'll learn more about as we as things go forward.
So let's dive in and talk about that, because we already have an email from Gregory who says, the whole Pope circus is comical and freaking annoying. The obsession with a bunch of corrupt old guys choosing a new leader in secret with no public debate is ridiculous. And we should say, out of the, 115 cardinals who chose the Pope, not one woman chose the Pope. Yeah, 115 cardinals. Gregory wants to ask about that. What about the allegations that he didn't protect the progressive priests back in the dirty war? And we just found a story at the Boston Globe that takes, actually it's the Associated Press. The Vatican is lashing out at what it's calling a defamatory and anti-clerical left-wing campaign to discredit Pope Francis over his actions during Argentina's 1976 to 1983 military junta, saying no credible accusation had ever stuck against the new Pope. What are your thoughts about how this is being covered? Because this is getting a lot of attention, especially this morning.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised by the Vatican's denunciation of the coverage. I would say it is too early for us to really know where the truth lies in all of this. There are reports about that Bergoglio worked closely with the junta, or at least did not work hard to stop some of the things the military junta in Buenos Aires was doing. And, of course, for your listeners who may not remember, about as many as 30,000 people, most of them leftists, disappeared during the first few years, really, of the military junta, which would have been in the mid-70s, basically, 1970s. You know, it was a very conflictive time. Now, the allegation against Bergoglio really involves around the disappearance of two specific priests who were working in a poor neighborhood. They were both Jesuits. Father Bergoglio at the time was the Jesuit provincial, meaning he was the head of the Jesuits in Argentina. And the allegation is that he expelled them from the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, and that gave a signal to the military that it was okay to go arrest them. They disappeared. They reappeared about 6 months later, 5 or 6 months later, drugged, dropped off on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. Both of them went into exile. One of them has since passed away, and the other one is still alive. And he issued a statement today, which I think is quite interesting, in that what he says about it, he gives the highlights of what his view of being picked up by the junta was all about. But he does not absolve Bergoglio. He just simply says, I'm unable to comment on the role of Padre Bergoglio in this matter. After we were set free, I left Argentina. I'm reading from the statement now. It was only years later that we had the opportunity to discuss the advance with Father Bergoglio, who in the meantime had been appointed Archbishop of Buenos Aires. Following that, we celebrated Mass publicly together and hugged solemnly. I am reconciled with the events, and on my part, consider the matter to be closed. Well, okay. Does that mean that the accusation against Bergoglio is untrue? I don't think he says that. Does it mean that the accusation is true? All he says is, I can't comment on what role Bergoglio had in this matter. And it's, you know, it bears some further exploration, I think. Now, is he reconciled to it? Sure, of course. He's made peace with the Pope, with a fellow cleric. That's not surprising, but I think it is... It's also instructive for us to understand in terms of Pope Francis what his experience was in Argentina in a very difficult time where many people walked a tightrope between the military dictatorship and perhaps their own progressive thoughts because they didn't want to be arrested. And perhaps they had other things they needed to be able to do to perform whatever it was their role in society. So, you know, I think it's something there'll be a lot of coverage of in the future. I would not say the Vatican statement is the last statement on it.
Will McClatchy reporters look more closely into this because mothers are still looking for their disappeared children at this point?
Well, I think that's, you know, the Mothers of the Plaza, and that's, you know, that's the group that still pursues their children. They're going to be very interested. They've been critical of Bergoglio. I think at one point he had them expelled from the cathedral in Buenos Aires. And so, you know, there's going to be plenty of discussion of the whole thing. Of course, you know, the church is into forgiveness, reconciliation, renewal. So I don't know that it will make a difference to him as Pope, but I think in terms of journalistic coverage and understanding who the man is, I'm sure it will be looked at, not just by McClatchy, obviously we are looking at it, but by other news organizations too.
We're speaking with Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondence. And today we are talking about the 24/7 wall-to-wall coverage of the new pope. And what are your thoughts on the coverage that you've heard and seen this past week, actually the past couple of weeks? What did you learn? What angles do you think the media should take on this story? We were looking for coverage of just how powerful the Vatican is, looking at the child abuse scandals and the cover-ups. What are your thoughts on this? Mark will be with us for about five more minutes, so now would be a good time to call it. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We've got an email from a listener in Berkeley who says, the European West rightly condemns the patriarchy and even outright male supremacy of Muslim fundamentalism. But the European West completely ignores giving any gender condemnation of one of the world's most celebrated, officially patriarchal and male supremacist institutions, the city-state and pomp of the Vatican. What does your guest think about that? And also, how do you think the media deals with this issue, or should deal with this issue?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, I think people who are Roman Catholics are Roman Catholics largely by choice. I think it, as a member of the secular media, I think coverage of those issues are appropriate in that we should understand who the Catholic Church is, what its influences are on our political system, and those kinds of things. You know, I think Catholics are aware that their belief structure is governed by people who have certain beliefs that perhaps are not widely held by secular society, or at least are very contentious within secular society. And there is always a conflict there. I think, you know, we have to recognize that the Catholic Church is, first of all, a religious institution. And so, it, you know, it's beliefs are its beliefs. For people like me who view the church or view its influence in strictly temporal terms, you know, then it's fair and correct to go in and critique, explain those beliefs. But I think it's an internal structure of the Catholic Church that is voluntarily exists for people who have decided they're going to be Roman Catholics. I mean, no one's forced to be a Roman Catholic, ultimately. I mean, you're born into it. And some people, you know, you're born into your religion, you're born into your religion. But in fact, everybody chooses that.
Well, and like the listener says, I mean, in the media coverage, you rarely do hear about the patriarchy. In fact, Reuters is reporting, in fact, this is their lead, an unholy alliance of Iran, Russia, the Vatican, and others is threatening to derail a UN declaration urging an end to violence against women and girls by objecting to language on sexual, reproductive, and gay rights. This is according to UN diplomats speaking out
on Wednesday. Well, I would say that's a good example of an appropriate reference to the church.
Right.
And it does, if I understand that lead properly, lump the Roman Catholic Church in with Iran and Muslims. And I have no doubt that's probably true. I mean, you know, there are a lot of... and that's the thing about Pope Francis that will be interesting to see how it unveils. I mean, he is... Excuse me. He is opposed to gay marriage. He is and has fought bitterly with the Argentine government over it. He is opposed to abortion rights, obviously. He is not a proponent of women in the priesthood. So he has a very, as you would expect, a cardinal. He has a very traditional view of Catholic teaching. He will be focused on the church's mission to evangelize, the church's mission to protect the poor, and maybe he'll do something internally about, you know, the Vatican hierarchy and the Vatican Bank and some of those other things. But I would not expect these big issues that are fissures within society itself for him to suddenly be some kind of liberal.
Well, we've got a few callers on the line, so before we go to break, let's hear from Linda in Berkeley. Hi, Linda.
Hi. You know, I just went on my smartphone the first day this was happening and found lots of articles, which have now been somewhat crowded out by CBS and the big guys. But I found some articles from Argentina, and I read everything I could get my hands on. And what came out of it was that he looks like he was doing the best he could, and he apparently took his life in his hands a couple of times doing some secret backroom things to protect the two priests' lives whose names are connected with him, and they did live and they were released, and at least one of them has spoken out about what he did for them. So, you know, overall, excluding the hype that we're getting from the American news, the BBC, Der Spiegel, all the others, you have to sort of and between the lines, of course. But
well, thank you for the call. Thanks for the call, Linda. Sorry to cut you off, but we're about to go to break. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear new voices. If you'd rather write than call, you can send an email, comment, or question to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up Sunday, May the 5th at 7:30, KALW presents David Sedaris at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco. Go to KALW.org for all the details. You can get your hands on some really good seats and an invitation to our pre-show reception as well. David Sedaris in San Francisco, Sunday, May the 5th. Details at KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we are going to mark the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. What has been the human cost of the invasion? We'll speak with a panel of Iraqi activists, artists, and journalists. That's on Monday. Tuesday, we'll look at the costs of the occupation and then take a look back in history to find out how we even got to this point. And then also this Sunday, there's going to be Accounts from the Front Lines. The event is sponsored by Iraq Veterans Against the War. It's at the St. John the Evangelist Church, 110 Julian Avenue in San Francisco. That is Sunday at 6:30. And you can find more information about this on our Facebook page. And if you'd like to join us today, we've got just a couple more minutes with today's guest, Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's Foreign Bureau as Chief of Correspondents. We are talking about coverage of the Pope, and we actually have a number of emails, and I'll try to get to those. But if you want to talk about this just quickly, we have about five more minutes left, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from a listener who says, the day the new Pope was elected, the CBS Evening News devoted its entire broadcast, except for one brief story, to the election and coverage of the new Pope. Thanks for that. Another email says, the facts are undisputed. The Pope kicked out two progressive popes for siding with the poor against fascism, and they were tortured. The church is responsible for millions of AIDS deaths in Africa. Thank you for that email. And then we have another email from Chuck, who says, clearly this is a huge problem, more or less, throughout the Catholic Church. The only way that pedophilia can be addressed is from the top. One can speculate that a man of the poor could also bring fresh sympathy to this issue, but it can only be addressed from the top. There are hints in the media, but nothing of substance. Why is this? And, you know, the same week, actually, Mark, that this happened, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles had to settle for child abuse cases for $10 million, and it barely got a mention.
Well, you know, of course, a diocese settling with over child abuse probably has stopped being news, and that they keep settling. But you know, I think we don't know what this current pope might think on that, might do on that, how to deal with it. To be honest, I think we, unlike say Mexico or Los Angeles or other countries, Ireland, where we know a great deal about child abuse in the church, I think we don't know much about Argentina yet, and that'll be something, you know, that we'll be examining.
Well, and don't you think journalists should be asking these questions? Because they interviewed so many people, authors and former priests and people in the Vatican.
Well, let's be honest, I think most people were caught completely by surprise that Bergoglio became pope. You know, did you hear a lot of discussion of his name beforehand? No.
No.
And it was a surprise. And in fact, one of the surprises was that he became pope because he was the runner-up the last time. And the tradition had been that you do not pick the runner-up from the last in the last papal vote because it seemed to be would be a slap at the pope who had just finished his service. So, you know, I think there were lots and lots of reasons that Bergoglio's ascension to the papacy was a surprise.
Well, we're going to have to closely follow this issue. There's clearly a lot of interest here, and we'll see where it goes and where this coverage goes in the coming weeks. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you.
That's Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's Foreign Bureau as Chief of Correspondents. He's been talking about media coverage of the Pope, and again, not one vote of the 115 cardinals was from a woman. A little factoid there that we thought you should know about. And we're now going to talk about Freedom of Information Awards. Earlier this week, Your Call producer Malihe Razazan and I emceed the 28th annual James Madison Freedom of Information Awards dinner. Every year, the Northern California chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists recognizes reporters who are dedicated to defending the public's right to know in Northern California. The Sacramento Bee won a News Media Award. Last year, the Bee uncovered millions of dollars in hidden assets in the state park system. Last summer, as the state was preparing to close 70 of its 278 parks and cut services at the rest for lack of funding, even as park officials last year asked Californians to donate money toward keeping their favorite parks open, and we did a lot of shows about this. They had accumulated $54 million over 12 years, twice the amount of the budget cuts. Longtime sources and public record requests were key to discovering the hidden assets. Stories by the Sacramento Bee's Matt Weiser, Kevin Yamamura, and John Ortiz resulted in resignations, firings, and criminal investigations. The Attorney General's office concluded that state park leaders had hidden the assets deliberately. Matt Weiser covers water, flood control, and natural resources as a senior writer for the Sacramento Bee, and he joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And the Journalist Award went to two reporters from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Over the course of several months, Jennifer Galan and Shane Shiflett interviewed dozens of sources, analyzed financial disclosures, court records, and judicial budgets to reveal that since 2006, federal judges in California entered more than two dozen rulings in cases in companies in which they owned stock, which is a violation of federal law. All of this work was accomplished in the face of resistance by the judiciary. Jennifer Galan is regional government reporter for the Bay Citizen, which is part of the Center for Investigative Reporting. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I know you just had a baby. Congratulations.
And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. So, Matt, why don't we start off with you? I mean, this was an explosive story because these parks were on the verge of closing. First off, talk about the process involved in figuring out and exposing that the Park Service accumulated $54 million over 12 years. When did you first even hear about this?
Well, it goes back quite a ways to some sources that I developed as part of a series we did on maintenance problems and crime problems in the parks. I met some park officials who ended up contacting me a couple years later with the story about this surplus money. And that initial contact on the subject occurred around November 2011, and it took about another 5 or 6 months to get the story into print.
And so talk about how you dug this information up. What was involved in that?
Well, it mainly involved talking to a lot of employees of the Parks Department who had heard about this and were, in other ways, they were fed up with the direction that the Parks Department was going. So I used the information they gave me to locate other sources and public records within the department to confirm what they were telling me. And initially, it seemed a little far-fetched that all of these millions of dollars might be hidden at the Parks Department at a time when they were closing parks. But it proved to be true, and it led to this pretty amazing story.
And where was the money hidden? What was it being used for?
Well, it was not being used for anything. It was hidden in two special accounts that are used to operate the department. One is called the Parks and Recreation Fund, which is the fund that collects all the revenues generated at the parks, things like entrance fees and camping fees and boat launching fees. And this is the main operational fund that the department uses to pay for operational costs at the parks. But they had been misreporting the actual fund balance to the Department of Finance, to the point that when the stories came out, there was an additional $20 million in that fund, which nobody knew about outside of a relatively small group of top officials at the department. The other fund was the Off-Highway Vehicle Recreation Fund, which had the balance of the surplus money in it. That ended up being a little bit different story in that the investigations later determined that that money was not hidden per se. It was just the actual fund balance there was very confusing because of the complicated way that fund is managed and the way that the legislature has transferred money in and out of that fund to balance the budget.
As a result of these revelations, State Parks Director Ruth Coleman had to resign. Other disciplinary actions took place in the department in 2012. What else happened? What else came of the report?
Well, there were four investigations done by the Department of Finance, the state controller, the state auditor, and the attorney general. Those were all more or less administrative investigations that shed light on who knew what and what they were thinking in terms of hiding the money. And then we recently learned that the attorney general is now doing a criminal investigation to find out if any of these employees broke the law. There is one provision of the penal code that makes it a felony for any public official to knowingly misrepresent the contents of a government fund, and that appears to be what happened here. So we're waiting for the outcome of that criminal investigation. Also, there was a state law passed late last year that reformed some of the ways that the Parks and Recreation Commission operates in order to give them a little bit more oversight power of the department. And that law also determined or laid out that some of the surplus money would be used as a matching fund to basically restore public faith in the department, so that if you donate money to the department now in a certain way, it will be matched by the money that was held in surplus in this hidden fund.
So what is the current state of the parks system in terms of financial health?
Well, it's still, despite the fact that this money was found, it's still on the rocks in a lot of ways. One of the other things that change in state law did was it allocated $10 million from the surplus for deferred maintenance in the department, and that is literally a drop in the bucket. There is over $1 billion in deferred maintenance throughout the park system, and some of these problems are very serious. You have sewage systems that are failing and causing water pollution. You have drinking water systems that don't work in the parks. You have campground facilities that are crumbling. So that's a huge problem that is still unresolved. There's also staffing shortages at some levels of the department, particularly interpretive services people, you know, the people who do programs in the parks that help visitors appreciate the parks and nature. And the ranger staffing is also very low. So this is something we detailed in an earlier story about crime in the parks that shows a steady trend in growing crime reports throughout the park system, partly because there are fewer rangers on patrol.
And that is Matt Weiser. He covers water, flood control, and natural resources as a senior writer for the Sacramento Bee. The Sac Bee won the James Madison Freedom of Information News Media Award for uncovering millions of dollars in hidden assets in the California State Park System last summer as the state was preparing to close 70 of its 278 parks. And you can find the package of stories at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Jennifer Golan. She's regional government reporter for the Bay Citizen, which is part of the Center for Investigative Reporting. And they won the Journalist Award earlier this week for their package of stories that found that since 2006, federal judges in California entered more than 24 rulings in cases involving companies in which they owned stock, which is a violation of federal law. And Jennifer, how did you first hear about this conflict of interest?
Well, we decided to take a look at the federal judiciary because they don't have a lot of scrutiny from the public. And of course, this is one of the most important pillars of our government. The federal judiciary rules on a whole range of important matters, and these are matters that are clearly in the public interest.
And so talk a little bit about the process involved in reporting this.
Well, what we did is it was quite simple, really. We cross-checked financial disclosures that these federal judges file in Washington, D.C., and over the course of several months under the Freedom of Information Act, collected those and cross-checked them with court cases that are available through what's called the PACER system, and it's an acronym for the Federal Court Records System. So we cross-check them. And my colleague and I, Shane Shiflett, worked together, and he took over the technical side and ran some of those cross-checks. We checked a lot of the records by hand going through PACER, and came up with a whole range of cases in which judges had made rulings, more than two dozen rulings, in fact, that involved cases with companies in which they own stock. And that's a violation of both federal law and the Judicial Code of Conduct.
So, for example, you pointed out in a November piece, Judge Manuel Real, a 46-year veteran of the bench appointed by President Lyndon Johnson, in 2008, he awarded Microsoft over $740,000 in damages and fees in a copyright infringement case. At the time, he held Microsoft stock between $15,000 and $50,000. In another 2008 case involving a contract dispute between Atlanta Cancer Care and biotech giant Amgen, he dismissed the suit against Amgen. He held again between $15,000 and $50,000 of stock. And the following year, he dismissed a lawsuit against Verizon. He bought Verizon stock worth $15,000 to $50,000. What was the fallout of this, specifically when you exposed Judge Manuel Real and his conflicts of interest?
Well, what was interesting about those three cases, Rose, is that the company stock in each of the cases rose at least $1 per share in the 2 months following Real's rulings or dismissal. So there was clearly a link and a benefit to the companies. While we can't prove any intent or understand whether Real had any real financial incentive in making those decisions, his rulings did have a substantial effect on those stock prices. So the judiciary for the Ninth Circuit has said that they were going to discuss this issue at their next meeting. So we're sort of in a wait and see mode on that one.
And that is Jennifer Galan, regional government reporter for the Bay Citizen, talking about her piece about judges and conflict of interest, rulings favoring companies in which they own stock. We're also joined by Matt Weiser. He covers water, flood control, and natural resources with the Sacramento Bee, and he uncovered millions of dollars in hidden assets, he and his team at the Sacramento Bee. And we're talking with Jennifer and Matt about investigative reporting. Earlier this week, the Society A Professional Journalist Northern California chapter gave awards to journalists and organizations who are dedicated to defending the public's right to know. And if you have questions or comments about the importance of this kind of reporting, I mean, there's so much of this great reporting, California Watch, ProPublica. The challenge is to really elevate these stories because there's just so much out there. So that's the big question, is how do you ensure that people actually read these articles? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If there's a great investigative piece you've seen over the last few weeks that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have questions for Jennifer or Matt about how they go about getting this information, because it's incredibly difficult. In some cases, papers have to spend tens of thousands of dollars. Reporters have to spend years submitting Freedom of Information requests. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So what about that question, Matt? How do you ensure that once write these explosive stories, that it actually gets attention so it doesn't die down quickly?
Well, in the case of the Park story, that wasn't really something I had to think about very much because the story itself was so explosive and the timing of it was such that a lot of Californians were thinking seriously about parks because the closures were literally looming at the time. So the story got a lot of attention on its own merits, I think. But one thing I would like to say is that one of the challenges for the news media that we've all heard about is declining staff levels at many media organizations. And fortunately at the Bee, we still have a relatively sizable Capitol Bureau, and my two colleagues who worked on this story, Kevin Yamamura and John Ortiz, were very helpful in understanding how state government worked in regard to what happened at parks. Kevin is our state budget expert, and John is our expert on state workers. And they both weighed in with some very important reporting. A lot of other news organizations don't have those kind of resources to cover the capital anymore.
Well, we have an email from John who says, I always appreciate good investigative journalism, but I wonder what the benefit is to society of going after these park officials. My impression is that they were not embezzling in any way, but were trying to help keep the parks alive, which is laudable. Yes, we're asking the public to chip in money to help the parks, but your guest points out that the parks are still in bad shape. The idea of them facing criminal charges for this is sad to me. I guess at this point, I would have actually preferred if the story hadn't broken. What are your thoughts on that, Matt?
Well, those are some interesting points. One of the things we learned from the investigations that came out on all of this is that the state parks officials viewed this hidden money as a kind of a rainy day fund that they could use if the park system ever encountered a crisis of some kind. And a lot of the reaction I got from people in the nonprofit parks world who support state parks was, well, isn't this a crisis if you're closing 70 parks and substantially curtailing park services? Wasn't this exactly the time that somebody should have raised their hand and said, hey, we've got $20 million over here, which can keep the parks open or keep services operating in the parks? That didn't happen. Everybody kept quiet about this money. And we know, as I said earlier, that there's a state law that states that public employees have a duty to be honest about how much money they're dealing with in these government funds. And it appears that may have not taken place here. So the reason for criminal charges may be to prevent this from happening again. It's unfortunate that someone may have to pay a price like that, but maybe the next time it'll encourage somebody to speak up when it can still be helpful.
And now that there's a criminal investigation, is it fair to say that this department is under the microscope?
Very much so, and they're aware of that. As you noted at the start of our conversation, the entire leadership staff of the department is new. There's a new director, new deputy directors, new people in charge of finance. They are very much aware that they're under the microscope, and they're trying to do the right things, I think, to be transparent about how they're handling the department's finances now.
And what about the judges, Jennifer? Have things changed as a result? Is it fair to assume that judges are no longer making rulings favoring companies in which they own stock?
Well, you raise an interesting point, Rose. There is no way to ensure that there's consistent oversight of how judges are going about using conflict checking software. They are required to use it, but there is no oversight to ensure consistency. And I would say, you know, we are really hopeful that our stories have bring about substantive change. Our attorneys have taken up our case to the federal judiciary. Because obtaining court records are so expensive, Shane and I applied for a limited exemption for PACER to waive its fees because we were, you know, researching this matter as a nonprofit organization, and the judiciary allows limited exemptions for nonprofits. So while we were initially granted a fee exemption, it was subsequently revoked on the grounds that CIR is a media organization, the Center for Investigative Reporting, I mean. And so our attorneys have taken up our case pro bono to the federal judiciary to ask that they bring their policy into line to address fee exemptions for nonprofit media organizations such as ours.
You mentioned the conflict checking software, and this cross-references judges' stock holdings against their courtroom dockets, which are supposed to automatically flag potential problems. But I'm assuming that, like most software, there are bugs in this, and maybe it doesn't always work?
That's right. There are many subsidiaries, and companies are changing hands all the time. So it's an ongoing process for the federal judiciary to keep up with this. And there is, again, no oversight to ensure that judges are using it say, every day versus every week or month, for that matter.
Do you think the public realizes in how difficult it is in many cases to get this information? Because it was interesting, on the night of the awards, so many journalists recognized their lawyers who are helping them try to get access to this information. And in many cases, it's a massive uphill battle.
It is, and that's one of the hard parts about investigative journalism. Often it's expensive, and to obtain sensitive records, often it requires a lawyer to get involved to pry these records loose from recalcitrant agencies such as the federal judiciary.
Mm. Yeah, we should do a show about this, because a lot of people also said that FOIA requests under the Obama administration are just as bad as they were under the Bush administration. And we have about a minute left. Jennifer, what are you working on right now? Are you taking leave off, some time off to be with your new baby?
Yes. Well, so baby is my focus, and also we have an upcoming project on pension obligation bonds. Local governments and state governments across the nation have gambled on their pension requirements for current and future retirees by taking very risky loans. And so we're analyzing, and we're going to come out with a report in a few months that goes into depth about what local governments are doing with tax dollars.
Oh, interesting. We'll definitely look for that. And what about you, Matt? What are you working on?
Well, I'm still covering the Park story. As I mentioned, the Attorney General is working on a criminal investigation, and there are other pieces of that story to follow up on still. And I'm also working on a story about the state's plan in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta to build a giant pair of tunnels to divert the Sacramento River, which is one of the most complex waterworks projects ever in the nation.
Matt Weiser is a senior writer with the Sacramento Bee, and Jennifer Gall is a regional government reporter with the Bay Citizen, part of the Center for Investigative Reporting, both James Madison Freedom of Information Awards winners. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Your Call on Monday. What has been the human cost of the invasion of Iraq? On the next Your Call, we'll mark the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq with a panel of Iraqi activists, artists, and journalists. How are Iraqis looking back 10 years after the invasion and occupation of their country? What is life like in Iraq today? What's the status of rebuilding efforts? Millions of Iraqis were forced to flee their country. So what questions do you have for them? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.